All right, good morning, everybody. So let me start. So I will start reviewing this thing, and you know, in case people come later, they have seen this already anyway, so it's okay. So we started discussing GR without actually doing differential geometry and without doing the real GR. But actually, we have already arrived at several predictions of general relativity. And you see that you can calculate them very simply by just playing with the elevators. And it all comes from the central idea of the equivalence principle, which stated in Newton's description is very, very simple. I express my Newton's law, F equal to ma, and I put the standard gravitational force for homogeneous gravitational field, described by gravitational acceleration g. So my force is mg times g. And of course, people typically don't write this I and g subscripts, and it's because it's well known that mg over mi is a universal constant, which is a constant for every and each body as we know it. And so this is still subject to experimental verification, but basically, so far, it has been confirmed for all the bodies. And so then it's just a matter of choice of the units, so that you can choose this constant to be 1. And in that case, of course, mi and mg cancel from this equation, and you arrive at an amazing conclusion that the gravitational acceleration can be mimicked by normal acceleration a. Okay, the gravitational force can be mimicked by normal acceleration. And so that actually was very much appreciated by Einstein, who called it like the happiest thought in his life. He came up with this idea of Einstein's elevator. Like, if you are confined to a box and you don't know what's happening outside because of this reason here, you cannot distinguish the two situations, when the box is accelerated upwards or when there is a true gravitational field going downwards with the same magnitude. Okay, and so we have this equivalence of these two systems, or you can make a small twist on this. And you can say, well, if I have no gravity whatsoever and floating in empty universe or whatever, then this situation should be exactly equivalent to the fact that if I am in a gravitational field, but actually I am freely falling down in the gravitational field. So my elevator is accelerating with the same acceleration downwards. So these two situations, again, are not distinguishable from the point of view of the observer who is confined to this box. Okay, and so this freely falling frame is called local inertial frame. And in that frame, the laws of special relativity, as you know them, will be valid. Okay, and so you basically know all the physics now. The problem is to include gravity. And you can include the gravity by basically ignoring it, going to the local inertial frame, calculating things over there, just using special relativity laws, and then maybe doing something else to include the gravity as we shall see today, for example. Okay, so anyway, there are immediate consequences of these things. And one of them is the light bending, as I tried to demonstrate yesterday. And by the way, light bending, of course, was the first verification that general relativity is the true theory and right theory. And of course, Eddington measured the light bending during the eclipse of the sun. And he measured that actually the light coming from distant stars get bent by the gravitational field of the sun, and it's like really the first verification of GR. But also, we have seen there is a gravitational redshift. So if you send a photon from down there in the gravitational potential, and that photon is going up, it has to climb up the gravitational potential, and it loses the energy. As a consequence, it's actually redshifted, and this has also been measured by Pound and Repka in the 60s. And that's another verification of GR, okay? And we haven't needed any differential geometry at this point so far. Are there any questions about this? Isn't this amazing? Like, it's just, you know, drawing pictures of smiling guys here in the elevator, and you have two fundamental predictions, each basically worth a Nobel Prize, okay? So now what we also seen is that we can start in this, you know, freely falling frame where everything is described by special relativity. In particular, the light and the particles, they move in straight lines, right? And so then, by going to a different coordinate system, we have seen that we can derive the geodesic equation. So So we will see how the motion of these particles and light look in a different coordinate system. But because we cannot really distinguish a change to a coordinate system from true gravitational field, the same equation will be also valid in the gravitational field. Okay, so we also derived the geodesic equation. And it simply reads, let me just use a different index, d square x mu d tau square plus gamma mu alpha beta dx alpha d tau dx beta d tau equals to zero. Okay, where? We've introduced the curve metric, which was again some coordinate transformation of the Minkowski metric, right, to some general coordinate system. But again, if you treat this curve metric simply as an object, as an entity on its own, then you can express these strange Christoffel symbols here in terms of this curve metric. And it can be written as such. Gamma mu alpha beta is 1/2 g mu nu. G nu alpha beta. So now we have to respect the symmetry. This object is symmetric in alpha and beta. So I have this term here. So I have another term where the two indices are swapped. So G nu beta alpha. And then this term also respects the symmetry between alpha and beta. Okay, so this is the prescription of the Christoffel symbol in terms of the curved metric. So now you see, so this thing here, of course, g nu alpha beta is the curve metric. So we are writing our line element as g mu nu dx mu dx nu. And this object here is the inverse. Okay, so it's similar to the Minkowski metric. You can write down the Minkowski metric with indices down, eta mu nu. But you can also write it with indices up. And that's an inverse metric. It's an inverse matrix, if you want. So the inverse metric is simply defined by, if you do g alpha beta, g beta gamma, delta alpha gamma. So really, this thing here is an inverse of g, right? So it's a misuse of notation. In some sense, you are using the same letter g. You should be, so if you did write this for the matrix, right, then you would write a minus 1 is equal to 1. Right, so this g is really g minus 1, okay? But people don't write g minus 1, instead they just write indices upstairs, okay? All right, so we have, I don't know, who has derived this formula in the end? Has anybody done the homework or you just simply believe me? Believing me is, okay, yeah, perfect. So somebody did the homework and it worked, hopefully, I hope. Okay, anyway, so that should convince everybody. Not what I'm saying, but that somebody actually checked that this formula is correct, and you can check it, the formula, you know, the formulas from yesterday. So now what is very important about this equation here is that we know that the gammas will be zero in the inertial frame. Okay, so then we are back to the inertial frame and to the straight lines. But this correction here simply accounts for gravitational, but also inertial forces. Okay. So basically, if I have true gravity, it will be described by metric g mu nu. I can calculate this gamma from there. And this will be my correction to that, you know, straight line equation. And if I solve this equation, I will find that my particles travel in a weird way around my gravitational source and so on. But at the same time, this equation also knows about the inertial forces, which come from changing the coordinate system from an inertial one to a non-inertial one. So for example, as was the question yesterday, if I change to a rotating frame, this equation will know that the frame is rotating, and these things will describe Coriolis forces, and it will describe, you know, other things, right? So this thing knows about everything. But what is amazing is that both these things, which are very, you know, may seem very different, this is like a true force, this is not a true force, they are treated in this equation on the same footing. So what you are saying is basically both of them are either true forces or not true forces, right? So these are treated in the same footing. And questions. So now yesterday, we have derived, you know, this equation and this relation based on the fact that we said, well, our curved metric is just a coordinate transformation of the flat metric. Okay, so yesterday we had that G mu nu was something like eta alpha beta dxi alpha dx mu dxi beta dx nu, right? And that means that actually our curved metric was related to the Minkowski metric by a coordinate transformation. So there was a coordinate transformation, which was x mu of xi was just a coordinate transformation. Okay, so in some sense, we have derived this equation only for inertial forces. Now the statement is, it will also be valid for the true gravitational forces. So now what is the difference between the two? So inertial, if you have inertial forces, then for them, G is really related to eta by this coordinate transformation. Okay, so basically what I'm seeing, which seems like a gravity, is in fact just a coordinate choice. It's an effect of my choice of coordinates. I'm describing things from a rotating frame, from an accelerating frame, from whatever crazy frame, right? Okay, so G will be related to eta by this prescription here if I'm describing inertial forces. And in that case, what you will find is that, so we also discussed that maybe the true gravity cannot be fully mimicked by this Einstein's elevator. It can be only mimicked by that locally in a small neighborhood of the point, right? But if I have true gravitational forces, they will be also tidal forces, okay? And so in that case, if I am describing tidal forces, if I'm describing inertial thing, the tidal forces will be zero. So tidal equals to zero. And in that case, I can really mimic everything by going to a freely falling frame everywhere, globally. So globally, I can have, can get rid of gravity. The other possibility is that you are describing true gravity, whatever that means. So in that case, G will not be related to eta by a coordinate transformation. So simply, you will not be able to find a coordinate transformation which would give you your G. Okay, it's also possible. In that case, if you are describing true gravity, they will be tidal forces. Tidal forces described by Riemann tensor, as we will learn next week. And in that case, you can get rid of gravity only locally. Okay? Only locally. This may be very confusing, but what is very important is that at this level of this equation, it doesn't matter which forces you are really thinking about. Whether it's inertial forces or true forces, doesn't matter from the point of view of this equation. This equation knows about both. Okay? Yes?
But what if I go to a different frame at each point? Can I then describe the tidal forces?
Okay, so locally at each point, you can always locally do it, right? So then, but the problem is that you may not be able to do it in a finite region of space, right? Locally, always possible. Globally may not be possible. Precisely, what is the distinction is that in one case your Riemann tensor will be zero, and in that case I am able to find a coordinate transformation which brings my metric to flat metric. In the other case, the tidal forces will not be zero, And in that case, I'm not able to find the coordinate transformation, which would globally, in that finite region of space, would bring my thinking to a flat space.
But can I like do it locally and then like glue these different vectors together somehow to get the tidal force?
You can glue them only when the Riemann tensor is zero. Very good question. Okay. So yes.
When you say can get rid of gravity, you mean I can go into my inertial frame, right? And then by the change of coordinates, which is...
So what I'm saying is that in this case, really your gravitational field sort of looks uniform everywhere, for example, right? So it doesn't matter whether my elevator is super small or whether it's big. If I go to the freely falling frame, in this finite region of space, I can get rid of gravity. In this case, in the other case, it will not be possible because these things will look like that. So locally, I can get rid of gravity, but not globally, because there will be these tidal forces.
I was confused about getting rid of gravity. I can go to the freely falling frame, right? That's what it
means. You can go to the freely falling frame, but in one case only locally, in the other case in a finite region of space. Yeah, globally. Yeah.
Does this apply to like, tidal forces?
Say it again?
Does this apply to like any tidal forces?
So this is very vague at this point. So I didn't explain what the tidal forces are. For us, is this just these arrows are not parallel or whatever, right? But you will see explicitly what it means in the differential geometry language. And yeah. All right. So now, very good. So we are constructing a new theory of gravity, which is now described by this metric tensor, G mu nu, okay? So now this theory better reduce to the Newton's theory in the appropriate limit. So let's see what are the conditions and that this is the case. Okay, so let me do a very simple calculation, which will be, so part B will be Newtonian limit. And what I mean by this, I mean Newtonian limit of this geodesic equation. Okay, so then what are the conditions under which we should expect that this equation over here translates to something familiar from the Newton's theory? Okay, so first, Newton's theory is non-relativistic. So everything has to be slowly moving and stuff like that. Second, we know that in Newton's theory, there is action at distance and the gravitational field is typically static. So you cannot have time varying, very fast time varying gravitational fields. So static limit you need. And so on and so on. So let's see what these conditions give. So first, let's do slow motion. Okay. So what that means is that if something is slowly moving, then the velocities are really much, much smaller than the velocity of light. Okay. In other words, if you think about this space-time diagram, you travel much more in time than you travel in space, right? So then you are slowly moving. You don't travel very far away, but the time elapses, right? So your condition would be the dxi over d tau, which is like the velocity, spatial velocity, is much, much smaller than dt over d tau. Okay? If you want, this is like a velocity vi, so the spatial velocities are really small. Okay? So let's see what happens here, right? So then we have the equation d square x mu d tau square. And that would be plus gamma mu, right? And then I have this index alpha and index beta, and I'm summing over both of them, which means there will be dt over d tau for alpha equal to 0, and there will be dx over d tau for alpha equal to 1, and so on, right? But then I'm using that only the dt over d tau is the dominant contribution. So there will be basically only one dominant contribution here if I neglect all the spatial velocities. And that will be g mu tt dt over d tau dt
over d tau equals to zero,
plus other terms which are, however, either linear in velocities or quadratic in spatial velocities, right? You happy with this?
So there will be plus other terms which are OVI or actually VI squared, because I can have velocity squared there, right?
Okay, so in the slow motion, the geodesic equation looks like this. It's very much simplified. So the second thing is, I consider really a static field. So static gravitational field. Or, you know, very slowly varying, time varying field. Which means that the metric will not depend on time. So g mu nu partial derivative with respect to t is equal to zero. Okay, so then in order to express what this equation means, I have to write down what gamma mu tt is. Okay, so I'm writing gamma mu tt. And then I'm using this horrible formula over here. Okay, it's equal to 1/2 gamma mu nu, and then g nu tt plus g nu tt plus minus g tt nu. I'm just applying the formula just over there, just plugging there that alpha and beta are equal to t and t. My time is my gravitational field is static, so this term is zero, and that term is zero. So I know that my gamma mu tt is just minus 1/2 g mu nu g tt nu. So our field is, we have slow motion, we have static gravitational field, but we also cannot have very strong gravitational field. Well, in Newtonian physics, everything is very weak. Okay, so we have weak field. That's another approximation. So weak gravitational field. So what does that mean? That in a clever coordinate system, I can write my g mu nu as the flat metric, eta mu nu, plus a small perturbation, h mu nu, plus 08 squared. So this is the flat Minkowski metric. That's my perturbation, describing, you know, the weak gravitational field away from Minkowski. And then I neglect everything of the order, which is of the order 8 squared and higher. So I only keep everything to the linear order in h. Questions? Yeah?
So what was the new h again?
So this will be like a small perturbation. Small perturbation from... So if I just put... So if I just put g mu equals to eta mu nu, I got rid of gravity completely, right? There's no gravity, right? But I want to have some gravitational field. But it's just a small gravitational field. Okay, so I only keep to the linear order in h mu nu, and I treat h mu nu as small.
Is it like global perturbation or like local?
Okay, so here, in order to compare really to the Newtons, I will in the end be using Cartesian coordinates. So I'll be saying like I'm very, very close to Minkowski. I sort of have Cartesian coordinates, but not quite in the Cartesian coordinates. This really is the of the form minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. Right, and so it's a little bit cheating, but it's like yeah, we are very, very close to Minkowski, so we are using sort of Cartesian coordinates here. Okay, so very good. So now I want to use this in order to calculate what this gamma mu tt is. Right. So for that, I need to express what the inverse metric g mu nu is.
Okay. So then the question is, what is this guy here? Right? So naive thing would be, well, it's eta mu nu. And then there will be a correction by this h mu nu. The only thing is it going to be a correction with plus sign or with minus sign? Okay. And the statement is this minus sign. Minus h mu nu. Okay. So how do you see this? Of course, you want to show that this thing here is inverse to that. Right? So what you are doing is basically you multiply, you have this, okay, g mu nu, g nu kappa better be equal to delta mu kappa. Right? But very schematically, and you can put the indices if you want, g mu nu with indices downstairs, eta plus h. Okay. G mu nu with indices upstairs is eta minus h. So let's see if this gives us delta, if this gives us 1. So eta times eta gives us 1. Eta times h with minus signs gives us minus h. Eta times h gives us plus h. That's why I'm putting minus h here, so that plus h and minus h cancel. And then you have h times h, which is of the higher order, and you neglect that. Okay, so this is 1 plus h minus h plus over h squared. Okay, which is what we wanted to show. So indeed, this is an inverse metric. Okay, so we almost have the victory now. So we want to calculate what this gamma mu tt is. So gamma mu tt. And let's see. So it's given by this formula. It's minus 1 half g mu nu gtt nu. Right? So now if I plug for this g here, eta plus h, eta is a constant, right? It's just minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. So if I differentiate eta, I don't get anything. So the only thing which I can differentiate over here is the h, okay? So there will be h tt nu, right? Because I cannot differentiate, eta would give me 0, okay? So I have to differentiate this guy. Okay, very good. But then I have minus 1 half, but I already have h here, and I'm expressing everything into the linear order in h. Okay, so if I plug for this inverse metric, eta and h, well, this h will already be quadratic because there's another h there. So this term I can neglect, and I can just write eta mu nu. Everybody happy? So now let's see what this equation gives us, right? So we have this equation here. That's our approximation. Let's call it equation. And let's look at, so now these are four equations, right? So we have mu, which runs 0, 1, 2, 3, or t, x, y, z, okay? So let's see what it gives us for mu equal to t, okay? So first, take mu equals to t. So then we have t squared x mu, which is mu is now t, so it's t. So it's dt squared, d squared t, d tau squared. Okay. And then we have to plug for mu here, t as well. Okay. That means that we are plugging t here. It means there is a t here, which means nu has to be t as well, because eta mu nu is diagonal. It's minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. So then I'm differentiating with respect to t here, which means our thing is static. It has to be 0. So it's plus 0. It's equal to 0. Okay. Because of the staticity. So in other words, from here I can integrate this dt
over d tau is equal to c equals to constant. Okay. And that's where I land. Well, you can also integrate that further, but we don't need to do that. So this is what I learned from the equation when we are plugging mu equals to t. For a second, we plug mu equals to j. Or I. So that we don't. Okay, let's put I. So then I have t square xi d tau square plus gamma I t t dt d tau equals to zero. Okay, so that's what my equation now says. Very good. So now I know that dt over d tau from the first equation is just a constant. Okay, so this is a constant, and this is the same constant. Here, I'm differentiating with respect to tau. But I can change that. I have an equation between t and tau, which is this one here. So instead of differentiating with respect to tau, I can do d square xi over dt square. But then I will have dt over d tau and dt over d tau again. So this thing here is d square xi dt square. But then I have dt over d tau twice. Using the chain rule. Now this is, again, a constant. So this is d square xi dt square times constant square. It's the same constant as over here. So my equation now simplified. And I can write it in terms of normal time. So I have that my equation now reads d square xi over dt square, normal time, plus gamma I tt equals to zero. That's what my equation looks like. So the last step is to plug in what this gamma I tt is. Okay, what is gamma I tt? So I'm plugging, instead of mu, I'm plugging I. So there will be I here. Again, it's diagonal, so nu has to be I, right? So I'm differentiating with respect to I, and then, you know, this will be just rise index, right? So what this actually means is that my equation now reads d square xi dt square is equal to, so now there's a minus 1/2. If I bring it to the other side, it will be plus 1/2. That's 1/2. H T T comma I. Okay, so this is what our geodesic equation yields in the Newtonian limit, which is the limit of slow motion, of weak field, and of not time varying field. Okay, so now does it help? I don't know. That's what it gives in the Newtonian limit. So now we need to compare with the Newton's theory to see, you know, what the Newton's theory gives us. And we know that in the Newton's theory, we have something like this, dt square equals to g. Right? That's our a equals to g again. Right? But we may be clever. We know that the g is in fact a vector, whatever. Right? And it can be derived from a gravitational potential. It's a gradient of the gravitational potential, minus gradient. So this is equal to minus gradient of phi. The phi is the gravitational potential. That's how the Newton's equation looked like. That's what Newton gives us. Well, very good. So now, what is a gravitational? Well, I should be putting an index here, right? So like that. I, I have an index here, I, it better be on both sides, okay? So what is that? In our notation, it's just minus phi I, okay? That's what's in our notation. Okay, now I can compare the two, and I immediately see that it means that the Newton's potential, phi, better be related to my HTT component in this way, minus 1/2 HTT. And if this is the case, then I have a perfect match with Newton's theory in the regime where the two should be, both of them should be applicable. Okay, so what I learned from here is that if I identify phi with this perturbation here, so in other words, if my GTT, looks like minus 1 plus 2 phi, and then let me restore the speed of light. So far, everywhere speed of light was equal to 1, but let me restore it here, so c squared. So if my metric looks like this, so it's flat metric plus perturbation. The perturbation is this, HTT, and the flat metric is minus 1. So this is your expression for GTT. If your metric looks like this, where phi is the Newton's potential, then in that Newtonian regime, the two theories will be the same, will describe the same physics. Questions?
Can I think of this H small perturbation as adding some small tidal force to the flat metric?
So let's not talk about tidal force. It will be, of course. Yes. In the end, it will be. But at this point, this is at the level of the metric. You're saying my metric is just a flat metric, but something which should describe gravity. And what I show you is that in the TT component of this here, what should be there is like the Newtonian's gravitational potential. Right, so it's really the GTT which encodes the Newtonian's gravitational potential in it, in the right regime. Oh. Right, of course, this theory which we are building here is much more general. It's applicable when the field is not static and the field is very strong, and you know, but in the Newtonian regime, GTT will be related to the Newtonian's potential in this way. Oh. Okay. So now, let's look at the validity of our calculation. When is our calculation valid? And in particular, we use this in a weak field approximation. So what we are basically saying, this H better be much smaller than this eta. Okay, so that's a small perturbation. We treat it as a linear perturbation. So this H better be much, much smaller than 1. So what we want from here is that phi over c squared, which is something like, if you want, in the Newtonian thing, gm over c squared r, be better much, much smaller than 1. Okay, so this is the Newtonian formula for the potential, as you know it from high school. And so this better be much smaller than 1. Okay, so I will just draw this stupid table. Like, when do you think this will break? Okay, when do you think the gr, from the point of view of like strong gravity, is really important? Of course, it will be important once you have time-varying fields and so on. But just, you know, let's say we have static field, but you know how strong the field has to be, what kind of object I have to have so that this thing would break down and I cannot use Newton's gravity. Okay, so stupid idea is, well, let's take proton and let's ask, well, proton has some radius. On the surface of the proton, how strong is the gravitational field there? Okay, it has some mass, I can calculate this Newtonian potential, and you will find that this thing over here is 10 to minus 39. Okay, so definitely satisfied. Stupid idea. Okay, so then you can say, it takes something which is maybe not so stupid. You can ask, what is the strength of gravity on the surface of the Earth? Okay, which seems, you know, should be very important, right? So when you calculate this thing here, because of the c square here, which of course c is really, really big, what you find is this is 10 to minus 9. Okay, so on the surface of the Earth, general relativity, not very important. Okay, then you may take sun, And if you take sun, you find 10 to minus 6. Also not important. So what on earth could be important, right? We already have star, which is like very, you know, very, very big, very, very massive, but still has very weak gravitational field from this point of view. So then, of course, you know that there are other objects. And for example, one of them is neutron star. Which originated from a collapse of a normal star. So then, however, because it collapsed, it sort of preserved its mass, but it's now much, 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 much smaller, which means, you know, this thing will be bigger. So on the surface of the neutron star, you already find that it's 10 to minus 2 or 10 to minus 1 in this range. So certainly for discussing neutron stars, Einstein's theory very, very important. And finally, you have black hole. So on the surface of the black hole, you find that this is 10 to minus 1 to 1, and of course gravity is very, very important there. Okay, so you can definitely neglect gravity, Einstein's gravity effects on the particle scale. You can even sort of neglect it, well, unless you have very high precision things for the object like Earth, but they are very, you know, they are very important objects in the universe for which this is actually the deviations will be huge. Okay. Yes.
Did the gravitational coupling change with energy in this calculation, or did we just plug in like usual?
The usual. Yeah, I'm not doing any Chi flow here or whatever. Yeah. So maybe this would. Okay. Fine. but here I just plug in the normal Newton's gravitational constant as we know it in classical world. Okay, so let me make a remark, which may be a little bit mysterious here, but it's a little bit important. So what our calculation showed here is that we have to have GTT of this form in the Newtonian regime, okay? But we haven't learned anything about other components of the metric, okay? And we will only learn that like in 3 weeks. But let me say what the result is. And actually the truth is that this gravitational potential will not only appear in GTT component, but will also appear in other components. Okay, so let me write down what this metric actually looks like. So remark, so we have weak and slowly moving gravitational sources. Then your metric can be written in the form Ts square is equal to minus 1 plus 2 phi over c square dt square, which is what we already know. But also there is a contribution of the phi in the spatial components of the metric. And in Cartesian-like coordinates, you can write it like this, okay? And this is what you will use, I don't know, in your homework and in your tutorial. So really, the phi not only appears in GTT, but actually it can be shown that it also appears here. But of course, we don't see this contribution in comparing just the geodesic equation. Okay? Questions?
Regard the
cosine in the
wouldn't it be c squared to
be d squared? It should be what? Yes, right. Probably c squared. Yes. Is that true?
Probably true.
Probably true. Thank you. Okay. Let's set it equal to 1 again, so that will be just 2 phi. All right. So now, let me return very briefly back to the gravitational redshift. And we have done this amazing derivation with the elevator, how the elevator accelerates up and stuff like that. Let's now do the same derivation, but equipped with the knowledge that, you know, our gravity is described by this metric. And then, you know, in the weak field limit, the metric looks like this and so on. So part C return to gravitational redshift. And so we basically know that our metric element, again, I'm setting C equal to 1, okay? So it's ds square is minus proper time square, but now it's given by the curve metric. G mu nu, dx mu, dx nu. Okay? So this would be like in the rest frame if you want. Like, I'm not moving. If I'm in the rest frame, only my time clicks, and that's my proper time, and there's no spatial motion. So this is fun. Okay, very good. So I can solve this for d tau, right? So I have d tau is equal to, and let's make, well, okay, it's minus g mu nu. And then what I do is that I divide by dt, and I multiply by dt. Why not? Okay, so it's d x mu dt dx nu dt, and then I put the dt back. Okay, so this is how my d of proper time looks like. So now let's assume that I send a signal from point one, and I observe it at point two. Let's say I have static observers here. Static observer sends a flash of light, and then there's another static observer at point two who observes that light. So the question is, this observer may send the signal with the frequency omega, and we already learned that if there is a gravitational field, this thing here may observe that same light with a different frequency omega prime. Okay, so then how do I calculate how these two are related? Okay, so it's very simple. I have omega prime divided by omega. But what I was trying to convince you is that the frequency always goes like 1 over proper time. That's the time which clicks on your clock, and the frequency goes like 1 over that. Okay, so what that means is that this will be equal to d tau over d tau prime. Omega goes like 1 over tau. Okay, so it's basically this thing here, dt in the point 1, and then this thing here in the point 2. Dt. But now what I'm interested in is static observers. Static observers are not moving anywhere, right? So for them, dxi over dt and dxi over dt will be 0. They are not moving. So the only contribution here will be gtt, dt over dt, dt over dt. So it's gtt. Right, so this is equal to square root of gtt at point 1 divided by square root of gtt at point 2, and of course dt cancels, right? sorry, there's a minus sign there. Minus gtt. And this is how you calculate gravitational redshift for arbitrary metric. Okay, so we have a beautiful formula. It's just omega prime over omega is just the square root of gtt and square root of gtt at one point or another point. But let's calculate it in the Newtonian approximation. So for Newton, in Newtonian regime, we know that gtt looks like that, okay? So in that case, omega prime
divided by omega is, so it's minus 1 plus 2 phi is GTT. We have minus GTT, so it's 1 plus 2 phi at point 1 divided by 1 plus 2 phi at point 2. And because I denoted by prime, which is very stupid of me, I should have been denoting omega 1 and omega 2, or stick to primes. Anyway, so by omega 2, by phi 2, I mean phi prime, right? So this thing is actually phi prime, and this is the phi in division 1. Sorry for that. But if we are in weak gravitational field, well, this is actually phi over c squared, really. So this is really, really small, as we demonstrated over there. So this thing here is approximately 1 plus, and then it's 1 half, I'm doing the Taylor expansion in phi, so it's 1 plus phi divided by 1 plus phi prime, which is like 1 plus phi minus phi prime. Doing the Taylor expansion. Okay? So again, if you do the gravitational redshift, omega prime minus omega divided by omega, it's this thing which we calculated minus 1. So it's phi minus phi prime. In particular, if you take homogeneous gravitational field, phi at one point is just given by g times height at that point, gh. At another point is g times different h. So this thing here will be equal to z minus g times delta h. And then if you want to divide recover speed of light, there back again. And this is the formula which we had already. Okay. So this is for homogeneous gravitational field. And that's what Pound and Ropcha measured. Homogeneous gravitational field. And so by now doing GR calculation, not elevator calculation, we recovered, you know, this amazing result of gravitational redshift in homogeneous gravitational field. Questions? Super simple, right? So now in your tutorial tomorrow, no, Friday, you will make this calculation more complicated by saying that actually these observers can also move. Okay, they can orbit around the Earth or whatever, and then what kind of redshift you can get. And, you know, you will just generalize this calculation to this much more interesting situation than maybe you send a signal from an observatory on the Earth to an observatory circling around the Earth in a rocket, and then you will calculate the redshift over there, or GPS or whatever. Okay. Questions? No questions. So this is very tiring, so why don't we get a 3-minute break? And then we can jump around and then ask questions and whatever. And then we can continue after 3 minutes. What do you think? Do you need the break? Who wants the break? 2 people. Everybody else wants to learn more about generality. Anyway, let's try it. Let's have 3-minute break and then we continue. Okay? Yes.
question.
Yes.
So when you write phi, comma, and the I on top,
uh-huh.
It's just like the derivative, but you raise it.
But with this delta I j or something like that.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
With the metric, or with it does raise it?
Well, in our case, it doesn't matter, but it's with the metric, of course. Everything is raised with the metric.
Okay.
But it's because we are already using this big field. It will be really raised with the eta, with the flat metric.
Yeah.
But then you are raising the spatial index, it will be raised with delta.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But in general, like everything, so you never make a mistake if you raise this with the right true metric, right?
Yeah.
But in certain approximations, it's just delta.
Yeah. So using some approximations, you can just rely to like something being like a gradient of H, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we said that
we said that
because it's a gradient, right? We can say that it's like the Hamiltonian equation if we make this equivalence between H and phi.
Exactly. So basically, you are in the regime where the Newton's theory should be valid. What we are really trying to do here is we are trying to build, you know, a generalization of Newton's theory, right? But this generalization be any good only if it yields what we already know is right in the right limit, right? So you really want to make a connection with Newton's gravity. And so the Newton's gravity tells you, well, what you should expect there is the phi. So that tells you, well, these two theories can only agree if HTT is phi. In principle, you can go beyond Newton's regime, right? So maybe you can say my sources are not moving so slowly, right? And then you will derive corrections to Newton, right? And what is actually really funny and what we'll see in 3 weeks is that the first corrections look exactly like electromagnetism. And so what you are really seeing is that in the same way as, let's say, moving charges produce magnetic field around them, moving masses will produce gravitor magnetic field, which is in the same way exactly as the magnetic field, and so on. So you will get corrections to the electrostatics, to the gravitostatics of Newton. You will first recover something like Maxwell theory for gravity, but then of course this goes beyond that. So the next level is like linearized Maxwell gravity, but then the full GR is even beyond that. Okay.
So you can write down.
Yes, and we will do that in 3 weeks. Yes. But that's not the whole story. It's just at the linearized level, basically, but you just allow for, you know, not slow motion, no non-staticity. Okay. Maybe. Everybody back here? Not really. So now let me discuss something very interesting, and that is one fake gravitational field, which would be provided by a Rindler frame, which is a uniformly accelerated frame. But we can have a very nice motivation why we should be dealing with a uniformly accelerated frame. And that is, imagine that you have a point charge. And the point charge is sitting in the lab, standing on the surface of the Earth. The question is, what is, the charge is not moving, it's just static there. The question is, what is the electromagnetic field of this point charge? What do you think?
I'm gonna have to make like a
second like image charge, right? Because the Earth is grounded. And, like...
Oh, I see. Okay. So very good, very good. So you are thinking about something much more complicated than what I meant. It's like, let's say I have a static charge. There is nothing around it, but it's static in the gravitational field, right? Is it a Coulomb law? Who thinks it's a Coulomb law? Okay, 1, 2, 3. Okay, very good. Is it a Coulomb law? Maybe. So it will definitely be a Coulomb law if the charge is standing in the, you know, very, very far away from gravitating objects, like in the empty universe, and then you have the charge static there, produces Coulomb law. But now the charge is standing in gravitational field. It won't be a Coulomb law. So when people measure Coulomb law, there is a deviation from it for static charges in our frame. Okay, so part D is the Rindler frame, and you can easily understand why this is the case. So let's have a motivation. And that will be a modified Coulomb's law. Okay. And basically what you are asking is that, well, you have the Earth like here, G, and then you have the charge, the electric charge, and you would naively think, well, this better produce Coulomb's law as we know it, intensity Q over R squared or something like that, but that's not the case. It's the field of this charge will be distorted from Coulomb's law because of the gravitational field, which is over here.
Because of we identify gravity with acceleration.
Exactly. So what does that mean?
This is retarded potentials, radiation and stuff.
Uh-huh, very good. You're very close to that. Yes, yes, yes. So now we have our equivalence principle, right? We have our equivalence principle, and we're saying, well, if I am in the freely falling frame, then my laws of special relativity are valid. So in the freely falling frame, if I have static charge falling with me, it will have Coulomb's law, right? So what I can do is, so this thing here is sort of equal to the fact that, well, this is our charge here. Let's say this is my freely falling frame. Freely falling frame. So now, if I had charge which was static in that freely falling frame, that would produce Coulomb law, right? But what about my charge which is sitting on the surface of the Earth? Well, if I am freely falling down, I see this charge accelerating upwards. This acceleration equal to g. That's what our Einstein's elevator is. Okay, very good. But it's in my frame where the special relativity is valid. But I see the charge accelerating upwards. So I have to use a technique which is linear to Wickert potentials to calculate what the field is produced by this charge because it's accelerating away from me. So field of this guy. Field is given by linear Wickert potentials. Okay, because the charge is accelerating. Have you seen this in classical physics course?
Mm-hmm.
Ah, very good, very good. So you've seen this. So you know how to calculate the field of any uniformly accelerated charge. Okay. But because the charge is uniformly accelerating, what do you expect? If anything accelerates, it also radiates. So actually, the fields which we calculate in this way should be radiative fields. It should be radiating electromagnetic energy. Okay. Doesn't look like Coulomb law. But of course, if we are looking from this freely falling frame where the charge is accelerating, we are not really describing the situation. What we should be describing is that when we are looking at this accelerated charge from a frame which is static on the surface of the Earth, such a frame is accelerated with respect to this frame. So now we need to look at this, from static frame on Earth. But this one is uniformly accelerated. With respect to a figure falling frame. So in order to find what is the field of this bloody guy here, what you need to do is go to the figure falling frame, see the charge accelerated upwards, you calculate its field using linear vector potentials, but then you have to transform to a coordinate system which is accelerated to this one, which is sitting over here on the charge. And then what you will find is that there is no Coulomb law. You will find that the field is again static, miraculously, although we have radiative field here. In that frame, which is associated with this charge, the field will be again static, but it won't be Coulomb law. There will be modifications which are proportional to the gravitational constant, gravitational acceleration, and so on. This is a beautiful calculation, and you will do it for your homework, okay? So this is your homework. But you will do it in relativistic setting. You will do it in the setting of Rindler frames. So this is not exactly that. The solution for this problem really exists. It's due to Linet, and it's 1976. Was the person, you can look it up, who found really what the field of a static charge on the surface of the Earth or close to the black hole or whatever looks like. And there are modifications of the Coulomb law due to the gravitational effects. But you will do some kind of calculation, which basically is an approximation of this solution. Okay. So now, how does that go? Question. Isn't this funny? Like, people, you know, build theories on the Coulomb law, but the Coulomb law is not Coulomb law as we measure it. Okay, there is deviations from it. But of course, the deviations are small because surface gravity of the Earth is actually small. Right. So. But if you are close to the black hole, the potential will be huge, and the deviations will be much bigger. Okay, so then nobody would claim that we have Coulomb's law if we lived on the surface of the black hole. All right, so let's now go to what is called Rindler frame. And this is, if you want, an example of fake gravity. So we will just mimic gravity with a coordinate transformation. Okay, so Rindler frame. So Rindler observer is a uniformly accelerated observer formally accelerated observer. Where it's for acceleration, a mu is equal to constant. So now we have constant for acceleration, okay? So if I calculate what the for acceleration is of an observer, I will say equal to constant, then this will be my observer which I'm thinking about. Okay, so now maybe you know that if you have Minkowski diagram, this is t and this is x, and I want to describe something which is uniformly accelerating. What it is doing, and let's say uniformly accelerating forever, okay? So what that object is actually doing is actually, let's say I start at infinity at the speed of light, and then the object starts coming to me, but it's decelerating this uniform acceleration, okay? Then it comes, you know, to some distance from me, there it stops, and then it returns back to infinity with the same acceleration. Okay, so that's the type of motion which we are describing here. Okay, so then it's not surprising is that the motion of this observer looks something like this. So it comes from infinity, infinite past, and in the infinite past, it's at infinity. Then it comes to some distance over here, and then it goes back to infinity later on. And if A is this, you know, constant acceleration, then the trajectory of this particle is t 1 over a times sine h a tau, where tau is the proper time of this thing, and x is 1 over a cosine h a tau. If you don't believe me, don't worry, you will derive this in your homework. Okay? So this is the trajectory of this object here. Okay. So now what you can do is that, of course, you can describe the motion of this object here in the Minkowski space. That's what we've exactly done. We are using the Minkowski coordinates t and x, and this is the trajectory of the object. Okay. However, we can also sit on that accelerated object and ask, you know, what is the natural coordinate system which is associated with this object? What the observer who would be sitting on this object actually sees. Okay? And that's called, you know, this Rindler frame. So Rindler frame. And you can get that frame by basically doing a coordinate transformation from Minkowski T and X to some new capital T and capital X associated with this observer. Okay, and so the transformation is this way. So you have the Minkowski T is 1 over A plus capital X, which is the Rindler X. So basically, you're getting from T and X, which is the Minkowski, to some new T and X, which is the Rindler. But you can also think of it as like a coordinate transformation, right? I'm just giving you a coordinate transformation, and it's sine H A times t, and small x is 1 over a plus x cosine h a t. Okay? So we are just going from coordinate t and x to coordinates capital T and capital X. So now what you observe is that if I, so trajectory of the object now, trajectory of the object, of the accelerated object, is now you set x equals 0. That's very natural, right? I'm sitting at the center of my coordinate system, so I'm setting x equals 0. And of course, t equals to tau. If I'm sitting there, I'm not moving in my frame, so I will measure my proper time, and so t will show my proper time. Okay? Does this make sense at all, or not really? Maybe. What is really funny is that if you calculate the metric, right? And how do you calculate the metric? You start with the flat Minkowski metric, and you do the coordinate transformation, right? So again, you can do it in your homework. So it's this formula, eta mu nu d xi over dx, d xi over dx. You can do this coordinate transformation. And what you will find is that in the Minkowski frame, of course, it's dx squared plus other coordinates if you're interested in other coordinates. But in the new frame, it's 1 plus ax squared dt squared plus dx squared plus other coordinates if you want. Okay, so this is the Minkowski metric, and the letter is the Rindler metric. This is the metric an observer in the Minkowski frame, static observer in the Minkowski frame, would see. This is the metric an observer accelerated in this Rindler, sitting on the accelerated particle, would see. Okay? So now, if everybody happy so far, or questions? Okay.
It's very, very deep physics here, okay? We're just doing a coordinate transformation, but we are learning something really, really new, and I'll show you what we are learning. So first of all, there's no singularities in this metric here. T can be, T runs from minus infinity to infinity, X runs from minus infinity to infinity, no problem whatsoever, right? What about here? Is there a problem with this metric?
Yeah.
And what is the problem?
Well, if we heat A minus 1 over X.
Uh-huh. Exactly. So then this suddenly becomes 0, and the metric is ill-defined. There's some problem here. Okay. So what it means is that, well, T still runs from minus infinity to infinity, but in order this metric to be well-defined, I have to restrict my X to run from 1 minus minus 1 over a to infinity. Because if I plug x into minus 1 over a, then this already is 0 and the metric is still defined and something wrong happens. Okay, the question is, what does that mean? Okay, so how do I find what the lines of constant t and what the lines of constant x look like? Okay, so I can play with this coordinate transformation. Let's see, I want how do lines of constant t and x look like? Well, in Minkowski, it's very simple. Constant t is just slices like this, right? Constant x is slices like that. What about my frame over here, okay? So, of course, you can look at this thing here. For example, what you can do is that you can divide your coordinate transformation. You can do t over x, and then it's sine h over cosine h, so it's tangens h, a times t, and then the brackets cancel, right? So this is how this looks like. So, for example, if I take capital T equal to constant, what am I getting here? That t is proportional to x. Okay. So what that means is that the lines of constant t are now tilted. So this is the line of small t equal to 0 equal to capital T. But then, you know, small t equal to 1 would look like this. Small t equal to 2 would look like that. But capital T looks like this. So this is t equal to 1, this is t equal to 2, and so on. It's the straight lines filling this thing here. Okay, so these are the t equal to constant lines. Okay, so from here, t equal to constant. Looks like, you know, this thing here. So then, what about x equal to constant? Okay, so then I have to do some horrible math. I better be using something like that cosine square h minus sine square h is 1. Okay, so let's do it. So what I have to do is that I have to do x square divided by bracket square minus t square divided by bracket square equals to cosine h square minus sine h square, which is equal to 1. Okay. And so then what you are learning is that 1 plus ax square is something like x square minus t square. Okay. Of course, you can solve it for x, but it doesn't matter. If I set capital X equal to constant, then I have constant equals to x square minus t square. So this will be, what is it, hyperbolas? Maybe. So we already know one such line, which is the x equal to 0 line. It's this line here. So this thing here is x equal to 0.
Now, x equal to 1 will look like this. X equal to 2 will look like that. X equal to minus 1 over a will look like that. So this is x equal to 1 minus a. That's where the hyperbola sort of degenerates into a null cone. And we cannot go any further. We cannot go to x smaller than that. So this is the end of the space-time. So what you just showed is that the Rinder space-time is actually limited. It doesn't cover the whole of Minkowski space-time. It only covers one quarter of that. It covers this slice over here. Okay, so Rindler only covers one quarter of Minkowski. So namely, if you have the full Minkowski, it covers this piece here. Okay. But there's something very, very strange happening at this x equal to minus 1 over a. What is happening there? So if I have, you know, events happening here, right? So maybe something happened here. The star exploded, okay? Well, the light travels at 45 degrees, so it can only affect things over here. So the Rindler observer will never learn about that, okay? This is true as long as the event happened in this upper one half. If it happened over here, yes, I can learn about it because light can travel over here. But if it happened in the upper half, I cannot never learn about that. So this thing here is some kind of horizon shielding what I can see and what I cannot see. Similarly, you know, from this region where the observer is, I can only send signals to this upper half. I can never send signal over here because I would have to travel with the speed which is greater than the speed of light. So this thing here is also some kind of horizon. So indeed, this thing, these lines here are called Rindler horizon. This one here, but also that one here. One of them is called the future horizon, the other one is called the past horizon, doesn't matter. Both of them, let's still call them Rindler horizon. What is really, really funny is that this Rindler horizon has so many common properties with the black hole horizon. Okay, so this horizon acts basically like a black hole horizon. In fact, what you will see is that when you will have a black hole, Schwarzschild black hole, the corresponding space-time diagram will look like this, okay? You live in this world, this is our universe, which is this one here. This is when we are outside of the black hole. There will be the past black hole horizon, there will be the future black hole horizon, okay? This will be now black hole horizon, this is a black hole case. Okay, black hole horizon. Okay, so now if you are here, you are inside the black hole. Okay, the only difference from the situation which we have here is that in our case, what's here is not interesting. The whole thing is just Minkowski space. It's just empty space. There's nothing interesting here. It's just we are describing the Minkowski space from the point of view of an accelerated observer. Right? What will be here is that there will be a black hole singularity inside the horizon. So there will be singularity like this. Okay, that's the only difference. Otherwise, everything is exactly the same. Okay? So now what you can, for example, calculate using your favorite redshift formula here. Well, square root of GTT divided by square root of GTT,
is the gravitational redshift. So what if I send signal from, you know, one observer to another observer here? I can calculate the redshift. It will be given by that formula. So now let's say that I put my emitter on the horizon, or whatever, here, okay? Then we can calculate the redshift. What you will find is that redshift is infinite. So whatever is sent from the horizon will be infinitely redshifted. The horizon is completely black, as is the case for the black hole, and so on. So you know, just playing this Brindle spacetime, you can basically learn about all the properties of black holes, as Ghazal will show you in about 3 weeks. Okay, is there a question? So now what is even more funny is that, so let me just make a bold statement that all black hole properties can be derived, can be, let's say, understood. So then it's not a correct statement. Understood by playing with Rindler. So there is a direct analogy, or more than analogy, between black holes, what happens with black holes, and what happens with this accelerated observer. Is a direct analogy. This analogy at this point is completely classical, this analogy. Okay? It's completely classical. Could it be also quantum mechanical? So we know that, maybe you don't know, but you probably heard about, that black holes do radiate away particles. They are actually, they behave like thermal objects. There's a Hawking radiation coming from black holes. Okay. Okay, let's use this one. So that will be my last remark. So we know that quantum mechanically, black holes radiate as blackbody, meaning the spectrum is the same. And you know that blackbody spectrum is simply characterized by a single quantity, which is the temperature of that blackbody, right? And so this temperature is given by kappa over 2 pi. Well, this thing here is surface gravity of the black hole, surface gravity. And so this is the temperature of the black hole as it radiates away. Okay. And so basically they emit spectrum of particles, and these will have energy spectrum like black body. Okay. And so this is called Hawking radiation. Okay. But if we have full analogy with this, with the Rindler spacetime, well, maybe the accelerated observer also sees some kind of Hawking radiation, some kind of temperature. Except it has a different name. It's called Andrew temperature. Okay, so for Rindler, the same is true. So the accelerated observer, also sees thermal baths of particles. And surprise, surprise, the temperature is given by this acceleration divided by 2 pi. So the surface gravity, or the gravitational acceleration on the surface of the black hole, is now replaced by the acceleration of your Rindler observer. Okay? And so this is a famous result. So this is called Andrew radiation. And so also about quantum mechanical properties of black holes, you can learn from the accelerated observer, from this Rindler frame. Okay. So interestingly, this result precedes this one a little bit, but basically nobody believed this result until this result came out. Okay. And so it's actually interesting.
So anyway, so basically what I'm trying to tell you is that you can understand all interesting physics just by playing this Rindle space-time, which we are doing here. And that's why you will be playing with that in your homework. Are there any questions?
So how did we, could you repeat like a connection between like Ringler horizon and black hole case? Is it like, so what we did there was from the accelerated observing, did we just say is it like Ringler diagram or like black hole?
So what you will see like in 4 weeks when Ghazal discusses black holes, and that you will see that, you know, so this is the space-time as we constructed it here, right? So there's nothing mysterious about this. So what you will see is that if you have like maximal extension of Schwarzschild space-time is like I have a collapsed star to a black hole, I have a spherical black hole, right? So then the corresponding diagram looks precisely like this, where, you know, this quarter here is where the normal observers live. That's where our normal universe is outside of the black hole. This is the horizon of the black hole. In that case, it's spherical horizon. So you know, there's like a region where the black hole is situated. And then if you want to cross this horizon, you're actually getting inside the black hole, and you eventually hit the singularity at the center, or whatever, right? But the diagram is exactly the same, and the function of the horizon is exactly the same, the physics is exactly the same. You'll find that, you know, if you want to send signals from this, from the horizon to an observer who sees it in our universe, they will be infinitely redshifted. So the horizon is a surface of infinite redshift, right? You will see all the photons like completely black, right? The same happens here. You can calculate it using the formula, right? So all the physics is basically the same, except that, you know, in this case, your horizon is spherical, right? In this case, it's really like if you are uniformly accelerating, it's not spherical horizon, right? So in this case, it's compact. In that case, it's not compact. But other than that, basically all the properties are the same. The only difference is that if I cross the horizon here, I end up in the singularity. If I cross the horizon over here, I end up in free Minkowski space and I'm happy. Okay? So that's the only thing. Different.
I have a question about the Poynting radiation. So is the cause in analogy with the Poynting radiation reproduction happening close to the Ringler horizon?
Oh, that's a very, very deep question. I don't feel to be the right person to answer that. So certainly, you know, what people have been trying to explain is, you know, is the radiation of particles from black hole. And how there's one interpretation how you can explain that is that maybe you quantum mechanically produce particles, right? And maybe it happens that one of the particles is actually underneath the horizon, okay? And then it has to go, you know, it has to stay there forever. The horizon is like you cannot cross the horizon out. Okay, and the other one is outside, and so the other one, which is outside, can escape to infinity, and you observe it as a Hawking radiation, right? So it seems like the Hawking radiation is somehow connected with the horizon, and it's like, yeah. So here, I think you could probably make the same argument, although I don't think you really need horizons for the existence of Hawking radiation. So it's a long debate. The person who will give you the right answer is Eduardo Martin Martinez. And he will be teaching like quantum information course later in Psi. So please ask him.
So what kind of particles are radiating away from this?
Well, in principle, all possible particles which you can think of. Of course, you know, if they don't have mass, if they are much easier to create, right? So mostly the Hawking radiation is dominated by gravitons and photons and, you know, these massless particles. If we have massless scalar field, or, you know, very little mass scalar field, then they will be also, you know, these particles will be also there and so on. It's like, in principle, all particles of standard model, but the massive particles are suppressed by the mass, right? All right. See you on Friday.